Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 11:34 a.m. That is Pacific Standard Time, and today is at 12. Excuse me, it is December 28th, and I thought that today I would look at a little bit more at India because we had this news today that Reliance Communications was has sold some of its assets to Reliance Industries, and part of the reason for that is because the company was on the cusp of bankruptcy. They are essentially now exiting the mobile telecommunications sector, and they're going to concentrate more on laying cable and trying to appeal to the wider business to business sector. What that highlights is that the Indian market is incredibly competitive when it comes to telecommunications, but it also helps to, I think, give us a very clear example of just how much of an influence new technology can have in leapfrogging legacy establishments. Because Reliance Communications had focused on it had, well, like I said, it picked up over the years fixed line telecommunications. It had spent a great deal of money laying down fiber optics, and it was completely outclassed by Reliance Industries, which just went straight for 4G. And of course, by going wireless, obviously it took a long time to get that wireless network built. They started it, I think, I may be incorrect in saying this, but it was back in 2013 that there was a significant investment phase in getting that network up and running, but you didn't have to lay cable. And what that has resulted in is when they launched it at the end of last year, that it has been transformative for Reliance Industry shares, which have been trending higher in a consistent manner. That's quite the contrast when you look at Reliance Communications, which went from 800 to 10 in the space of the last decade. And 4G is an incredible enabler for economic growth in somewhere like India, because what it allows is hundreds of millions of people to have access to the economy. For a largely illiterate population, the rolling out of fingerprint technology, and that also took a number of years to collect all that data from people, but now it has been launched, so people can log into their phones with their fingerprint, and because of voice recognition technology, it means that they don't necessarily have to be able to type to be able to find what they want, and the voice communication that modern phones have means that details from a page can be read back to them by the AI present in the phone. So all of that ensures that hundreds of millions of people now have access to online banking. What that also means is that for the banking sector, they are not under nearly the same pressure to build a branch network that they would have been in a legacy system. That the rollout of online banking, of social media, and the review system is really quite an incredible breakthrough for India. Now, what has always hampered India remains infrastructure. It's a question that companies like Amazon and its Indian competitors are attempting to fix by trying to come up with a way of getting deliveries to the right address, and that is a compounded difficulty by the fact that there isn't necessarily an easy way of doing that, rather than having a network of people who know where they're going. That's one of the hindrances with a country like India, because it has got this infrastructure deficit that it embraces advances in technology, and most particularly in the IT field, and that has also fed through into the pharmaceuticals field. But what it needs is, in fact, what China has, which has been this drive to innovate in terms of just pushing through infrastructure projects. That's something that India still has to do. When we look at what's happened in China over the last decade, there has been an incredible transformation where we've had this incredible explosion in the review system, and that has delivered customer service literally out of nowhere in just the last 3 years. The picture, the difference between my experience in China a couple of years ago relative to my most recent trip in July, I hardly believed I was in the same place. That the standard of customer service has been on a par, if not exceeded, anywhere else I've ever been, regardless of where we're talking about in the world, because of this review system. That because the Chinese consumer has a fundamental suspicion of the motivations of the vendor, that they rely heavily on other consumers and their reviews. So they will, in large part, make their purchasing decision based on the reviews. And that is equally applicable to where to go in, what restaurant to go to, what to order at that restaurant, and what shop to go to, what to buy at that shop, what product is best bought in which location. And what that is creating is this competitive environment among vendors to deliver customer service and hand-holding. So when we think about what is happening with the Chinese consumer sector, then we can look, for example, at like an ETF that is simply relying on the consumer sector, and it has been trending higher in a pretty consistent manner all year. But perhaps the more important consideration is that it was trending down from about 2010 until about the middle of this year. It wasn't really until about September that it was breaking up and out of this rather lengthy range. So this, I think, is the realization in 2017 that China is turning very quickly into a consumer-driven economy. And again, that is the successful implementation of a number of strategies. What it is also helping to do is to in many respects, solidify the party's control over the economy, because with the rolling out of a consumer economy, there is much greater potential for surveillance and for, I think, a bread and circuses type of administrative control rather than the hammer and sickle, which has probably been more associated with the economy heretofore. Well, copper prices have continued to remain firm, and they're breaking up and out of this range, which has been in evidence now for the last 4 months. When we think about what's going on in China, that they are trying to get their pollution under control. Some of the well, I've seen a number of articles talking about deficits in the copper market, but it's really that China is attempting to curtail its domestic supply so that it can control its inflation problems, and that's a particular issue in the winter, where northern China just gets blanketed in heavy smog. But what we're also starting to see are articles talking about China's increasing reluctance to take trash from the rest of the world, that it has for such a long time acted as not only the manufacturer of, for or the workshop of the world, but also the recycler of the world, and that's a heavily polluting industry as well, so they're unlikely to want to continue to do that. So what we're also seeing is, because of the success of the consumer market, that is going to increase demand for lots of different commodities, and it is also helping to change the supply and demand outlook for various underlying commodities, because obviously copper in per capita in use of the industrial metals like copper and zinc and tin increases with the role of the consumer, as people buy more consumer goods and white goods, then their demand for all of these metals tends to increase. Now, quite whether we are then also going to see continued growth in demand for steel is perhaps an additional question. Lead prices have been largely range-bound since 2009 and are now testing the upper side of this long range. Obviously, the evolution of electric cars has put a bit of a dampener on the ability of lead to advance because of the lack of a need for a lead acid battery. But what we are starting to see with nickel is that it has bounced reasonably impressively from the region of the trend mean, and there is the potential that this contract is going to get split in two, with a particular focus for nickel sulfide on the battery sector. Sherritt International is a share that tends to look rather similar to the nickel price, and it also has cobalt assets. When we look at a number of the resources-oriented economies, the UK falls squarely in the middle there, because when we look at the constituents of the FTSE 100, then it has got both energy and materials representing fairly significant weightings in tandem with the banking sector, and it extended its advance mildly in here today to continue to push on to new high ground. The FTSE 350 is also pushing on to new high ground, and when we look at that on the long term, we can see that it has outperformed the FTSE 100 fairly substantially over the last 3 or 4 years, not least because of its more of a domestic focus. But now that we're moving back into, I think, a more widely accepted synchronized period of synchronized global economic expansion, then the FTSE 100 has the potential to play catch up with more domestic plays in the UK. And the AIM 100 has been the clear outperformer in the UK this year, and the pace of the advance has moderated, but it continues to hold this progression of high reaction lows, and the reactions have been relatively similar sized, and it has bounced again over the last couple of weeks. And as long as it is holding that progression of higher reaction lows, I don't think anyone is going to be particularly worried about it. And the fact that small caps in the UK had been ranging for the better part of 5 years and are now in a position of outperformance suggests that despite a lot of the doom and gloom that has been pervaded in the media, that the UK economy and the UK stock market continues to benefit both from the relative weakness of the pound and the distinct absence of a contraction in the economy, at least so far. What we are starting to see is that there may be some break for the UK in terms of what we can expect from the negotiations that are due to begin in January. Theresa May is going to be meeting Macron in January as well to talk about what exactly it is that the UK can achieve. Then you had reasonably sanguine remarks from Merkel over the weekend, and this is all contributing to the potential for a reasonably benign environment coming through from the UK negotiations. We did have a bout of volatility on Christmas Day on the euro pound exchange rate, where it got almost all the way up to 115, but closed out the day closer to 112.5, and since then it has been relatively inert. But what it I think in order to really demonstrate that the pound is back in a position of demand dominance, it will need to sustain a move above 114. I've still got my long position, but I am not going to hold it indefinitely if the pound isn't going to rally reasonably quickly. And what we're also starting to see is that sugar prices have begun to firm over the last couple of weeks. There's still a progression of higher reaction lows, and this continues to look like base formation development. But now that the price has rallied for, I think, what is it? It's seven, 6 of the last 7 days. Then now the question is, how much of this advance is it going to hold when it has already unwound this oversold condition relative to the trend mean? The fact that oil prices remain really quite steady around above the $65 area suggests that Brazil will be burning more ethanol because of the somewhat higher oil price, and that should be beneficial for sugar prices, and not least because they are really quite low at present. And when we look at Europe and what is going on there, then the Italians are going to be having an election at some point over the next 3 months, and it's probably going to be a hung parliament. And the stock market index has been largely range bound for the last few months, and it has unwound most of its overbought condition relative to the trend mean. It's testing this 22,000 level, and it really will have to bounce from that area to confirm that this is still a demand-dominated environment. I think when we really address the simple fact that it has been ranging in a very volatile manner since 2009, and it is towards the upper side of that, what I think is probably a base formation, then its ability to hold the region of the trend mean is rather pivotal here, because if this is a long-term base and bases are characterized by volatility, then it could quite easily pull back and go right back down to the lower side of the range if we get some adverse effects. I don't think that that is likely when we're still in a period of economic expansion, but it will have to bounce pretty soon. When we start to think about what's happening for next year, then the fact that Italian government bond yields are at 1.95% and the US Treasury is just below 2.5% suggests that, well, I think that it's symptomatic of the fact that the ECB's quantitative easing program has been incredibly distorting to the bond markets. The ECB is going to be tapering their purchase program in January, so that means they'll be buying fewer, particularly German bonds, but also bonds from just about everywhere else, and that purchasing has been in proportion to the size of the respective economies. But what it also means is that there'll be less support for government bonds, and if that also suggests that spreads between Germany and the peripheral nations will begin to widen out again, and that represents a bit of a challenge for those economies, and it also represents a challenge for the political class, because they need to start to come up with either a plan for greater integration, which will necessitate more sharing between the various economies, and that's not going to be particularly welcomed, particularly for German taxpayers in particular. So there is certainly the potential in Europe for more volatility next year as the ECB begins to taper. But I think probably not at the beginning of the year, but probably more towards the end of the year as the tapering ramps up and we come towards the end of that whole program. And when we look at the US markets, the Nasdaq remains really quite steady and is approximately 500 points overextended relative to the trend mean. But again, that is less than about 10%, but it is somewhat overextended, and there is potential for some pause of consolidation. The Dow Jones is also really quite overextended, but the size of the reactions has been incredibly mild, and this pause that we've had for the last 7 or 8 sessions has been very mild indeed as it consolidates. I think, and I'm very slow to call this a consolidation because the size of the reaction has been so very mild, but it's pausing at least in the region of this 25,000 level, and that represents a fairly significant milestone in terms of the advance so far, considering that it started out the year below 20,000, it's ending the year just below 25,000, and I suspect that we might get some pause or consolidation additionally in this area. But a clear downward dynamic would be required to really suggest that that is indeed the case. When we look at the USA's banking sector, it will benefit from the tax cuts that have been announced, and this is, I think, one of the more important characteristics. What I intend to do for tomorrow, considering that it is the last day of the year, is to compile a list of companies that derive the majority of their income from the USA. So they should be those that benefit most from the tax cuts, and to perhaps do then a review of how consistent their trends are. but the banking sector certainly falls into that category, and it has broken up really quite impressively over the last few weeks. So it is somewhat overbought in the short term, but really a sustained move below the trend mean would be required to question that this isn't still a recovery scenario. And because we're in a period of synchronized global economic expansion and we're also getting fiscal stimulus in the world's largest economy, then there is the potential that 2018 could see trends begin to accelerate. And that would probably coincide with more tightening from the various central banks, and eventually that would contribute to a top. Obviously, acceleration is when we make money fastest. It's when the argument for why prices should go up becomes even more compelling, because we have the benefit of experience on our side that the prices have already been rallying for a long time, and they have, I think, overcome the naysayers. But the bigger question then will be when are we going to have the next recession? There's no sign of it right now, and if that is indeed the case, and we haven't yet seen the acceleration, then acceleration remains perhaps the most likely scenario. So this is still an environment where one should remain long. And I think with that, I will leave it for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.